On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5 foot 7 inches tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to Missing Maura Murray. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
Doing very well. How are you today?
I'm doing well. We have a sort of a throwback episode, Lance, coming to our audience here today for episode 97. It is an interview, or really a conversation, with old friend Clint Harting.
Clint Harting, the return of someone who came into our world, came into our universe early on and had his theories about Maura and the disappearance. He was very passionate about his theories. And there was a point where he could, and this is why I really love this interview, again, so far removed from the first interview, he could have maintained his position and just dug himself deeper and deeper and deeper as far as his theory is concerned, but he really didn't. He says that he's contributed as much as he can to this. He knows that some of his original theory was flawed, and he identifies that. So he's sort of the type of person that we talk about who's gone through the rabbit hole and come out nearly a better person on the other side.
I would say so. And you could hear it in Clint's voice. And he really is still passionate about the case and wants a resolution just like we all do. So we kind of range a lot of topics, Lance. One of them later in the episode is about Cecil Smith, the first responding officer to Maura Murray's accident site, committed suicide.
Yeah, when the news came to us about Cecil's suicide, there was just like a wash of emotions. I don't know if you felt the same way. It was first just how tragic that was, because we knew that he was suffering from early onset Alzheimer's, and that affected, obviously, anyone who's had family who has experienced Alzheimer's early onset or Alzheimer's itself. It affects everything you do. It is a painful, painful thing to watch any one of your loved ones go through if they have that, if they're afflicted with that. And the tragedy of someone taking their life and knowing that might have been a contributor to it, is really, really sad and tragic. And our hearts just go out to his family and the people that he touched in his life. The other part that came up was it was so close, and this is the elephant in the room, it was so close to the 15-year anniversary of Maura's disappearance. It was just about a week later that he took his life.
Yeah, and there, obviously this lead has been highly publicized, and so we just want to ask people not to connect the dots there. It's just not really responsible or fair to Cecil and his family. It's a tragic situation, and it's a sad loss, because the only person who spoke with Maura, Butch Atwood, is deceased. And now the only person who spoke with Butch Atwood that night is also deceased.
It's accurate when you ask people to try not to connect the dots between the timing of his suicide and the revelation of this new lead that happened at the 15-year anniversary. We do understand, though, that it's nearly impossible to not connect the dots if you're following this case, to not try to do that anyway. But you have to take in all of the other factors that you probably don't even know about that might have been going on in Cecil's life. We've received communications from people on both sides of how to approach this. There are people that have reached out to us and said that it's absolutely impossible that he didn't have anything to do with it because he killed himself. And then there's the other side of it, like we hear Clint say, yeah, obviously it would be a tragedy. It would be horrific if he did have something to do with it. But for the most part, that's not where your head should go. You should identify that the timing of it, while it is extremely coincidental, I'll say, probably had nothing to do with it. So you can at least address that. But please, like you said, don't try to force some sort of connection between it. Even if it, and I don't want to say this and have it come off wrong, even if he did have something to do with Moore's disappearance, this is so serious. This is not something that just anybody should be trying to approach. This is 100% law enforcement.
No one knows why he did it, and to speculate on it is just not helpful. So there's been no official word on why it happened, and let's just leave it there for now, and we'll hopefully get some word, maybe some official word on why down the line. But for now, let's just all be respectful to Cecil, his family, and the officers who knew him, who were his coworkers, who likely loved him.
And we can say right now, to answer a couple of questions that are just pressing probably in people's minds, we don't know if there was a note. People will ask a lot, was there a note? Was there something to indicate that? We don't know. We don't know if the family knows, and we also don't know where the investigation stands at this point, if there is some sort of investigation or if it's just been ruled as a suicide.
And this is a good time to say that if you are feeling depressed, look, it's something that a lot of people experience during their life, but there are people who care and there are people who will listen to you if you need to talk to someone right now. So call 1-800-273-8255, and that's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Or you can chat with them online. Okay, Lance, and with that said, let's get back into the business of this episode here. And a couple of announcements. We are going to CrimeCon in June in 2019 in New Orleans, Louisiana. So we would love to see you down there as well. CrimeCon is such a great time. It's like the most fun weekend that I've had in my life over the past 2 years, Lance. And I expect it to be a third here.
Every Sunday that we've experienced at CrimeCon, we have just watched the time wind down. We've watched Podcast Row start to break down. And it's really sad because it's like we got to wait another year to do this. It's a really unique moment where you get to go and experience a one-on-one interaction with people that you follow, whether it's podcasts, whether it's law enforcement, television personalities, journalists. Last year was amazing with Billy Jensen, Paul Haynes, the Golden State Killer revelation. It was just incredible, and money well spent. First of all, New Orleans in June, just that alone is reason to go, but then add CrimeCon on top of it. Again, money well spent.
You're going to have a great time.
You're going to have a great time, and you are going to save 10% by using CrawlSpace19 as your promo code when you go to CrimeCon's website and register for your standard 3-day pass.
Use code CrawlSpace19 to save 10%. It is a good deal. Get yourself down to New Orleans for CrimeCon.
We'll get some jambalaya.
Now, Lance, we're also doing this event next week, actually, next Wednesday, I believe.
It's, no rest for the wicked, Tim.
We're going to be at the Riverwalk Cafe in Nashua, New Hampshire, doing a forensic science panel. Lance, what do we know about forensic science?
Well, I don't know, but we're going to brush up on it on the car ride there. Just kidding. No, we're going to contribute as much as we can. We're going to provide as much insight as we can based on our interaction with our listeners and interaction with law enforcement through the years that we've been doing this. And again, it's the Science Cafe Forensic Science Panel, Nashua, New Hampshire. Cute little place, the Riverwalk Cafe at 35 Railroad Square. Again, Nashua, New Hampshire. See if you can get a chance to be in Nashua and get down there.
Yeah, it's next Wednesday, March 13th. 2019, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., and we're going to be joined by some really impressive people, unlike us, Lance, law enforcement and science people.
I think they're just asking us to come because they need somebody to take tickets at the door or something.
I'm not convinced they just want to ridicule us as well, but we are going to join, and it's really going to be fun.
So it could be you see our face when you first come in because we'll take your ticket, or it could be the Lance and Tim roast, or we could actually provide some unique insight. Either way, it's a win.
So check us out. That'll be fun. And check us out on Stitcher Premium at stitcherpremium.com. Lance, we're doing these creator commentaries for this podcast, Missing Maura Murray. We're going through all the old episodes and talking over them and updating the information and giving our own personal behind-the-scenes look at what it was like to produce these episodes.
Yeah, back then we had one way of looking at things. We had one set of tools that we used. Today is a completely different story. So we're correcting ourselves. We're also giving ourselves a little bit of a self-effacing, which is fun in between the information and the, you know, at times heavy elements of what we do.
And hard to avoid when someone, I think probably anyone, goes back and listens to their own work. It's just not that easy to do. It's kind of cringy. But
yeah, especially when you're dealing with details.
Yeah.
Like specific details that they're either right or wrong. It's not like, oh, well, this might have happened.
And Lance, our 100th episode of this podcast is rapidly approaching.
Really? I couldn't have guessed that we'd go beyond 12.
I know. I remember it feels like just yesterday standing in your old kitchen talking about how many episodes we could actually do with this show.
Maybe 12.
I think I said 5.
I might have said, I think we could do double that.
But so we are going to do a little celebration, Lance, for the 100th episode. And we used to do these Facebook Lives after the Oxygen show aired. So I think we're going to do some kind of Facebook Live event and use that audio for the 100th episode. So if you can join us for this Facebook Live event, it is going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to do callers. We're going to take callers.
Right. Stay tuned for this. We'll have the date. And we do know that we will be presenting our callers through a company called Pulse Cellular, and they will offer a 10% discount off your monthly wireless bill using promo code CRAWLSPACE. So our 100th episode will be presented by Pulse Cellular, and you can get 10% off your monthly wireless bill by using promo code CRAWLSPACE. That's a great deal. This company reached out to us because they want to implement something within their cellular system, within their cellular software. I'm not sure exactly, but it's a child preventative measure to keep kids from being abused online. So they have sort of a stake in the game, if you will, as far as the true crime genre is concerned. And yeah, so our phone is going to be powered by them. We'll have a special crawl space telephone now, and that will be all on the Pulse Cellular network. And feel free to call in. Feel free to call in, and we'll have someone screening the calls, and it'll be a great time for the 100th episode. No filters.
Yeah.
Just go.
Let's just go with it. It'll be fun. So look out for that announcement with the date and time and everything. Okay, Lance, let's get to our interview with Clint Harding. Welcome back to Missing Maura Murray, Clint Harding. Clint, how are you today?
Guys, what the heck is going on?
Oh, good to have you back, Clint.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, I think the last time I was on, I think Tom Brady was just finishing up his first Super Bowl victories. It's been a while.
It has been a minute.
So how have you been?
You know, pretty good. Been pretty quiet, actually. I've kind of stepped away from this case and just really minding my own business, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, that does tend to be the case, you know, on occasion with people who look into Maura's disappearance. You do need a bit of a breather if you're just going at it alone like you were. Can you refresh anyone's memories and especially the new listeners? Who are you? Where do you come from? What's your connection to the case?
Sure. My name is Clint Harding. And I, at one time, was a professional journalist, 14 years I did that. I found the Maura Murray case, by as many people did, by watching the Disappeared episode. And, boy, that really hit me, that watching that show, listening to Fred Murray talk really hit me. And I wanted to dive in, and I didn't really want to participate ever in any way with this case. But, you know, it just kind of roped me in, and I wanted to go in and see the way I thought I could help was taking all the misinformation that was out there and trying to untangle it and trying to make it more clear. I thought with my background of researching and journalism and all that kind of stuff that I'd be able to help out in that way. And, you know, then it seems like at the same time I was starting out, James Renner was starting out with his blog. And so I kind of was talking to him in the beginning, and then you guys came out with your podcast. And so that's how I, you know, got into the public venue of this. My intentions were never to ever even chat about this case publicly, but I started doing that as well through the different forms. Web Sleuth was the one I really was most active on, and then Reddit later on. So
it was primarily posts that you submitted to Web Sleuth and Reddit. You didn't officially have your own blog, though, right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. But like I said, when I started out, it was almost the exact same time James Renner started out. He was putting out little teasers for a blog that he was getting ready to start at the time. And so I started emailing him back and forth, and everything just kind of, James Renner is the guy that really got this case into the public spotlight.
For better or worse, we've said that as well, that if it wasn't for James Renner, I don't know where the attention would be on this case.
Exactly.
Because
exactly,
we don't even know probably hundreds of missing person cases that don't get this attention, that don't have a blog that's solely dedicated to them, which then inspires a podcast and inspires a television show. So for better or worse, like I said, he was the catalyst.
He was the catalyst. And in this case, I mean, you have so many characters, you have so many people that are, I don't want to say pushing narratives and all that kind of stuff, but I mean, you have the opinions for this case are so strong and so varied. Anybody that looks into this case seems to get wrapped into it. If they take a hard look at this case, they're probably going to get wrapped up in it in some way or some form or fashion.
Yeah, it's very easy to get obsessed with this case, as we've seen over and over again. But Clint, it's really good to hear your voice on these airwaves again. And have you disengaged from Reddit and the online community completely? Or
oh no, I still try to stay updated on things that are going on. I just don't comment very much anymore. There's been a lot that's gone on since probably the last time I was on your podcast, and I'm just like everybody else. I like taking in the new information and comparing it with what I've been told and seeing where things are at.
Now, speaking of new information and old information, you said that you started looking into this and you started publicly posting about it to clear up the misinformation. Can you give us an example of some of those pieces of misinformation that you felt you've cleared up in the past?
That's just it. I don't think I've cleared up anything.
A loaded question, you know, Lance.
What I mean is, you know, I've gone on Web Sleuth, Reddit, topics back in the day. I've tried to make my points numerous times. I feel like a broken record a lot of times, and I just don't, you know, I don't feel like it's really resonated. So as far as my purpose of clearing up all the misinformation, I don't think I was successful at that. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of information out there that I just don't believe, whether we're talking the police conspiracy angle stuff, whether we're talking even basics about the case, you know, Mara's dorm room being packed up, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that I would call spin, and yeah, I try to do my best to be as accurate and factual as I possibly can, and just hope that I'm right, you know.
Yeah, and I think your contribution has been successful without a doubt, because what you've done is given a perspective, that voice, essentially, and it's led to a lot of great debate online and on these airwaves and everywhere. So I think that's very valuable.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, I want to try to help out as much as I can, but it's important to hear what others have to say. And if you present the information as factually as you can it's okay if they don't agree with you. It's okay if they come to different conclusions. It's just important to have those debates. And I do feel like that's something that I hopefully have been a positive contributor to.
Yeah, I think so. And so what about the Oxygen show? I think the last time we spoke to you was before the Oxygen show. And your main, I don't know if you want to call it a theory, but your guess of an outcome was that Mora and correct me if I'm wrong, but was suicidal and went to the White Mountains to commit suicide.
Yeah, that was my working theory. And I actually, right now, if I had to say, what is your theory? What is my theory on the case of Mora Murray? I would say I have absolutely no idea what happened to her after she had the accident. And that's the only 100% thing I am sure of when it comes to this case is I have no clue what happened to her once eyes were off of her.
Well, that makes three of us, Clint.
Yeah, and suicide, I still believe that when she went to the White Mountains, it was because she was depressed. I do not buy, and I've never bought, that she was taking a mini break or, you know, going to a party or meeting somebody. So I've never bought any of those theories. The information that I've been told in private and you know, just from researching publicly, has led me to believe that she went to the White Mountains and she was not in a good place and she was depressed and had been depressed for a while.
But that is separate from her disappearance now in your head?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Once she had that wreck, everything's open. You know, everything's possible as far as what happened to her. You know, what kind of condition was she in when she had that wreck? That's one thing we don't have an answer to. You know, the one witness that actually got to physically talk to her is no longer with us. And the police officer, unfortunately, recently also is no longer with us that talked to the witness that actually talked to Mora. So, yeah, both of those guys that are no longer around. And, you know, we're just never going to probably know, you know, exactly what kind of state she was in after that wreck. And that's an important detail in my book, as to trying to figure out what happened next to her.
Yeah, like Jim Clemente said, former FBI profiler, he did a mental autopsy of her beforehand. And that's something that has been coming up a little bit more with this, because there are those different schools of thought. Did it matter what condition she was in mentally, or doesn't it matter? Are they two completely separate things?
Right.
Because
mentally
whatever it was
physically
brought her there, and physically. So. What do you mean by physically? Like after the accident?
Yes. Yes. How shook up was she from the accident?
Gotcha.
Was she intoxicated? I think those are very valid questions that we'll probably never know the answer to. I can't clear up one thing. There was a lot of early reports that the driver was intoxicated. That came from Cecil Smith. So, you know, obviously he's not around anymore, so we're not going to be able to really dive into that and find out exactly, you know, why he came to that conclusion himself, because from him talking to Atwood, that's the conclusion that he came up with about Mora, was that she was intoxicated.
Yeah.
Based on the alcohol in the car.
And from what Butch said.
Right. But I've always gone towards the school of thought that if she was that intoxicated, she would have gotten into an accident before that corner. Because that road is windy, it's you know, dark out, and I just feel like she would have got into an accident sooner if she was as intoxicated as people make her out to be.
And that is a very good point, because, you know, I've made that drive myself, and you're right. The turn that everybody talks about, the turn where she probably did have her accident, there's actually a turn right before that that's even sharper.
Yeah.
And it's even tougher to negotiate.
That's true.
So that is a very valid point.
But who's to say that she barely navigated that curve, and by the time she got to the curve by the weathered barn, she just couldn't navigate that one, and she ended up overcorrecting. I'm just
exactly.
Also, there was alcohol splashed around the car, and there was alcohol that hadn't been opened yet. So that doesn't mean she consumed it. That means that there was still alcohol that was unconsumed. Therefore, she wasn't drinking it, and therefore she wasn't drunk on that particular alcohol.
And to be 100% fair, when Cecil Smith talked to Atwood, we don't know how that conversation went. But we know that Mara Murray, from hearing the different accounts in Atwood, I don't think he's – I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I don't think everybody portrays him as a guy that's given like 8 different stories, and I don't see it that way. I see a guy that's talked to different reporters, and they've had to interpret what he's told them, and they've told it a different way maybe than the other guy has or other gal.
I 100% agree with you.
And that's coming from someone who did journalism. So, yeah, I think right. That's a very valid point.
So back to Cecil Smith, you know, one part of the Atwood's account is that Mara struggled to get out of her car to talk to him. Her door was hitting against the snowbank, and then she was just struggling to wiggle. She had to wiggle out, and she was peering over the roof of her car. So maybe, there's a lot of room for interpretation there and how Atwood told that to Smith. Maybe Smith took that as somebody that was maybe intoxicated. He took that with what he saw in the car and around the car, and then Atwood's account. So we don't know. We're never going to know how that conversation exactly went. So we're just left to speculate one way or the other.
Am I correct in thinking that there was an early newspaper article that Butch Atwood gave an account of Mora needing to hold herself up by the car?
I think that's from Smith. I think that came
was
from
the
Smith.
Oxygen show. Yeah, that was Cecil said that on the Oxygen show, I believe.
That Butch told him that. Okay, so that wasn't written anywhere?
No.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of. But that the first time I heard that was on the Oxygen show.
Okay. Yeah. So you could ask
me about the Oxygen show, so I'll go ahead and tell you my thoughts on that show. I gave it a B overall. So, after each episode was over with, I was cussing. Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? After the totality of it, if I had a little patience, and listened to it all the way through, I think they did do a very good job of kind of touching all bases, whereas you watch one episode and you're like, oh, this is going to be slanted so far one way. I think they did a really good job of touching on everything. So, that kind of wipes out a lot of my early criticisms of the Oxygen show. Now, that's not to say I thought the whole thing was perfect. And, when you're covering Mara Murray, I don't care if you're journalism, podcast, TV show, you're going to have criticisms, and you're going to have people that just flat out think you got an agenda and you're lying or whatever. So obviously that's the, you're never going to have please everybody. And then with the Oxygen show, I thought they did spend too much time disproving James Renner's theories. I don't know if that was the plan or if that's just how it came across, but I thought they spent way too much time on that. Yeah. And as far as when they wrapped up the theories, I know they had to, it was TV that they probably had to do it the way they did it, but I didn't like the way that they kind of summed up and wrote off theories so quickly like they did. It just didn't made for bad TV, I thought. I know that was not probably an intention, but I know they spent hours going through probably every theory in every possible scenario, but it just didn't look right on the TV show.
Yeah, that's one of the dangers with producing a show with so many different circumstances and elements and facts and speculation. They have to leave some things on the cutting room floor just to make it a consumable product.
Yeah. Also right. With TV, like as you said, that conversation probably lasted like a couple hours, but it's cut into 2 minutes.
Yeah. And, right. And it's all cross cut with Strelzin, side glancing the entire, all of the conversation. Like, they have to create some drama with it. But I do agree with you. And we've said it before. If you don't look at it like episode by episode and you look at the sum of the parts are more important than the little bits and pieces of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And obviously it got a lot better when the two wildly popular podcasters made an appearance.
You know what? I'd have to agree with that.
You had it at a D, and then you're like, whoa. Whoa, Lance lives in that house?
Yeah.
That was not my house, by the way.
Yeah, we heard from Captain from True Crime Garage, who was jealous when he saw us walking out of that house. He was like, damn, Lance has a huge house.
Like, how does he afford that? So they looked into buying a home as well because they thought that true crime podcasting was enormously successful financially. But that was
you guys got your $10 million studio now.
Yep,
$10 million studio.
Man, I'll tell you what.
We actually can't even afford the microphone, the speaker that connects to the computer. It just crapped the bed on us.
So, what about the dorm room photos? Those came out last year, the summer of 2018 at CrimeCon. What did you make of the dorm room photos? You kind of mentioned what you thought of her state of her dorm earlier, so I just wanted to circle back on that.
Well, so the whole thing the dorm room photos, the dorm room is a big controversy, right? You know, you have the police that came out and said she was all packed up, ready to go. Didn't look like she was planning on returning, but then you have family sources that say, you know, she probably just didn't have time to unpack from winter break. So you had this big to do about the dorm room and how it was left. And then these photos come out, and I'll be honest, they don't do nothing for me. These photos you don't have one picture of the big thing that was in dispute when it comes to the dorm room, which was how her bed was left. The police describe her bed as being left with stacked boxes on the bed with a note left on top of the box. Now, to me, that would be the most important photo that I would want to have if I was, you know, really releasing all of the dorm room photos what was on her bed and how was it left, because that would either completely prove what the police said is true, or it would prove that they got their information completely wrong. And so instead you have these crop photos. You have one of two bags on, and you don't know, you know, what the context is, because the photo's so zoomed in on the bags, you don't even know what that's supposed to be. You have a picture of her door. Okay. I don't know how that's supposed to help. You have a picture of a computer desk. Okay. We know she left her computer there. That was never in question. And you have a picture of a closet that looks like 75% of her hangers are empty. So going off of those pictures, I don't think it resolves anything, unfortunately.
What is your opinion then about the bed not being present in these photos? Do you think that they never took a picture of the bed, or do you think that there is something there that they don't want people to see?
I think they definitely took pictures of the entire room, not just crop photos. I think they took a picture probably standing in the doorway, just shooting the whole room. The room's not that big. So I think they took a whole picture of the room. I think they took a picture of the bed. They probably took an individual picture of the note. And that's probably how Mr. Scorenza, Lieutenant John Scorenza, the former lead investigator of the case, that's probably how he came to his conclusions. He probably talked to the UMass police officers over the phone, but he probably got those photos as well. And that's probably how when he briefed the FBI about the case, that's probably what he was basing it off of, was the pictures that he had of the dorm room and his phone conversation with Thrasher and Davies, who were the officers that were in Mara's room with Billy Roush the day that her dorm room was searched. And why don't we ever hear from Billy? I mean, Billy Roush, who's now evidently public somewhat about the case, he could clear up in a minute how her dorm room was left, and he's never made a public comment about the dorm room.
We do know that he's taken to Twitter a little bit more often now, and we do know that he listens to the show. So if he wants to reach out,
come on down and tell us how this dorm room was left, because, you know, I still feel like we don't have any resolution to this. And this is something we should have resolution to, something like this.
I think that's fair that the photos don't really depict her state of mind. But I think what the photos do show is that it wasn't a woman who was leaving her life forever. I will make that argument, I think, you know, but by the photos and the things left, it's hard to say what purpose she left for, but I would say it's not.
It's a very, very ambiguous feeling you get from it.
Yeah. I mean, she left her stereo. There's just too many loose end coats and everything. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, the police were pretty specific in their statements, both to the public and to the FBI, that, you know, how the boxes were left, the note. They keep bringing up that note that was on. And they don't ever call it a suicide note. That's such a fake straw man. They never called that note a suicide note. They've always referred to it as a personal note left, and you know, they may have gotten it wrong because it was actually an old email, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. So you can quibble about, you know, they said note and it was an email, but I mean, you're really not even arguing anything. You're just trying to confuse the situation, if you ask me, if that's your argument over, you know, what the police said.
Yeah, and I think that we can take out of the first bit of conversation here is if Bill Rausch wants to shoot us an email and just say, this is what my interpretation of the boxes on the bed looked like or the entire room, then we can put the call out, open door, shoot us an email and let us know. And we'll, if there's anything important to it, you know, we'll obviously share it, that if it is anything that we can share legally.
Yeah. And I talked to privately, I've talked to a resident advisor, I guess you call him that, that was in Mara's dorm. It wasn't the resident advisor that went to Mara's dorm, but she you know, obviously knows the one who did go into Mara's dorm room. This resident advisor actually went into Mara's dorm room before the police ever got there because an alarm clock was left and it was going off. And when she went in, or he went in to Mara's dorm room, their interpretation was that the room was packed up, like somebody was moving out. So
that's very interesting.
But again, that's, you know, you can't, that's more hearsay because I didn't talk to the actual resident advisor that went into room. I talked to the second resident advisor that was there. So can't really call that a fact, but I have no reason to doubt the credibility of the person I talked to.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Do you take anything into consideration regarding Mora's intentions to return because the alarm was going off? Should we think about that for a little?
It's an oddity.
Mora's alarm.
I mean, I guess you could look at it that way. Why would you forget about your alarm clock? But I don't know. I think you could go either way with that.
You could just simply forget to, you know, turn it off, I suppose, but interesting. Right. I'd never heard that.
Yeah, no, I definitely had never heard that. That is very interesting. Here's a question. So part of those pictures that were given out last year for CrimeCon, it included a receipt from the liquor store and the purchase that she made before leaving. It is heavily redacted, unfortunately, so you can't actually see what was purchased, which is still kind of interesting, but if Mora got into the car of someone she knew, wouldn't she have taken all of the alcohol, not just the bottles? She would have taken the wine. She would have felt comfortable enough to take all of it.
Well, I think the wine, we're talking about the box wine, right?
Right.
So I think that was already damaged, or at least that's what they believe. So that's probably why she wouldn't have taken that, is it was already smashed up. Personally, I think she already had it open. The bag anyway, and it probably just spilled once she had her wreck. So as far as the rest of the alcohol, you know, why wouldn't she take her personal belongings?
That to the personal belongings as well.
Well, it sounds like she put a couple of the bottles into her backpack. Right?
That's what we think because, you know, they believe that she had a black backpack that was never accounted for. And then the bottles of alcohol were never accounted for. So that kind of seems like she took the bottles and stuck them in her backpack. But again, that's, you know, it's just speculating.
Right. She could have dropped them off somewhere else.
We don't even know for sure if she had a backpack. I think that's just speculating. I don't think anybody, there's nobody. Atwood, I don't think, ever mentioned that she had a backpack. So, yeah, we're just speculating on that. But, I believe that she had one. I believe she, you know, her family thinks she had a black backpack, so that she carried, I guess, with her all the time.
Yeah, well, all of the items in the car were indicative of a short trip. She had a duffel bag of sorts where, you know, it was obvious for, like, overnight clothes and toiletries and typically, you'd carry a backpack with you, I suppose, for smaller stuff, or if you're just going to pop out for a day. I have no idea. Again, we're just speculating.
This is definitely speculation city, but
assuming she
took her immediate belongings, which was her ID, her keys,
cell phone,
and these couple of bottles of alcohol.
She left her, I guess it was her stuffed, now I can't remember if it was the stuffed animal her dad gave. I think it was her dad gave her. It might have been her boyfriend.
Yeah, it might have been.
She left that behind, and that supposedly was very important to her. She left a necklace behind that was very important to her, and she left all of her, rest of her belongings behind. So to me, I guess if we're talking like tandem driver or something like that, it doesn't make any sense. If a tandem driver stopped to pick her up, so they're going to let her get her stuff. They're not going to say, get in the car. We got to get out of here. Don't get your stuff.
This is indicative of her intending to return.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, even perhaps return to that car.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, like a box of wine, obviously, I don't know what state that was in, but those boxes of wine have a little bag inside where the wine actually lives. So maybe that cap was off during the accident or something like that.
Right.
But it's hard for me to believe or imagine, really, that the box was and the bag were both smashed. You know what I mean? So I think it could have easily just have been taken. So I guess what I'm speculating about is that, she put the bottles in her backpack, so she didn't want this person to, whoever's car she got in. I mean, I guess technically if you bring an open container into someone else's car, that's now that person driving is committing an illegal act.
Yeah.
So
Correct. Maybe
that's why she didn't bring the wine. I don't know.
And she could, I mean, she may not have gotten into another car, so that's still out there.
It's true.
Yeah, we're just speculating there. The box wine thing's interesting because I did, find out many years ago when I was researching that was her go-to drink. That was her favorite drink. She only drank wine out of a box. So people say, she got that because that shows she was going to a party. No, that was actually what Mara liked to drink was that Franzia boxed wine. So
yep, still
that's,
exists
that's
today.
At least I guess you'd call them family sources have said over the years.
Sure. Now, what do you think? You mentioned Maura perhaps not getting into a car. How did you feel about the fish and game section of the Oxygen show where Todd Bargardis comes on?
And I think they did a really good job. I should backtrack on that because they took too long, I think, to actually get out and search. But when they did finally do the searching for Mara Murray, they did a really good job around the area of the car accident, which is how you would proceed. I mean, most people that go missing from where their car is abandoned after an accident are found within a real close range of that car. So it just makes sense that you would hit that area as hard as you can. But she gets outside of that area, then it's ball game. It's a whole different ball game. So that's the whole thing. And I know they said they didn't find any footprints, and that's supposed to be the big clue. But if she walked along the road at any stretch, I don't think she would have left footprints that would have been found. So to me, it's wide open. I still think there is a good chance she got into another car, but at the same time, she could have walked up the road 2 or 3 miles and then got off. And that could be an area that didn't get searched.
Right, at least immediately.
Right.
What do you make of the new leads that have come up if you've been paying attention to them?
Well, you know what? And this is going to sound kind of snarky, and I apologize for that, but it's A-frame part deuce. It's the exact same scenario as the A-frame house that was searched. It was a local rumor. Fred Murray had been told early on. He wanted to pursue it out. He finally got an opportunity to have the A-frame searched in 2006. He the story behind that, obviously. And he got a key from a realtor to access that house. And now we got another house. I guess it's somehow tied into the A-frame. But we got this other house now. Same scenario. Police didn't get involved in the A-frame search, and they're, as of right now, not getting involved in this search. So what you have is you have consistency. You have police that aren't jumping to go out and dig up this new lead, just like with the A-frame house. They kind of sat on the sidelines on that one too, so you know there's consistency there. I don't know what that means exactly, but I'm down. I mean, if you're a father of a missing girl and you get local rumors, even you got to pursue them. I mean, you don't have a have the option of saying, well, I don't think this person's credible or this account. If there's local rumors that have been going on for this many years and you haven't gotten a conclusion on them, even if it turns out to be nothing, I think it's worth it. I mean, I think it's worth pursuing. So it's probably going to have to be something that Fred and his folks have to do themselves, though. I don't know.
What do you make of the media surrounding the new lead and Fred Murray and the rest of the family basically publicly calling out the police and saying that they're just not moving on this at all?
Just like the police and their consistency and how they've handled the A-frame and how they've handled this, Fred and company have been very consistent too, that, you know, public criticism on the police and keeping the pressure on, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's the same thing, man. It is A-frame part two all over again. Or it's A-frame part two.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't really, didn't really hit me like that, but your perspective definitely makes it seem like it really, really is kind of a similar situation.
Please, and I get out there and get it searched, man. I'm not one that says, you know, oh, we shouldn't follow up on this, blah, blah, blah. No, this, it needs to be searched. I'm glad you guys did what you did with the A-frame house. I'm glad that others, you know, everybody that contributed to do Four Sears property and the A-frame house, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if, as long as it gets done, you know, that's the kind of thing you want to see get done, regardless of the outcome.
Yep, we agree. We have said numerous times that we will go up there with GB Geotechnics. They've offered to do it for nothing. So they'll do that service gratis. And we know that the owners of that house seemingly are willing to have something dug up. It doesn't have to be the entire basement floor. It can simply be a 1 foot by 1 foot cross section that they pull up.
Mm-hmm.
But the services are available and the money is there if needed. So
right,
we're just waiting for the go ahead, to be honest.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I definitely hope it gets followed up on. This is not something that I hope just kind of disappears. I hope it gets followed up on, and you never know. I mean, never know what you're going to find.
By all accounts, there is or was a dead body in the cement floor, because the cadaver dogs, they don't just randomly sit down when they get a positive reaction to it.
I don't know. We got an email recently, someone saying that electrical currents could give off a false reading for cadaver dogs. Also said that the cadaver dogs will respond to blood and not just like decomposing humans. So maybe someone cut themselves, you know, I don't know. So it's more speculation city, but...
But they did have two dogs, and it'd be weird to me if both dogs got all cross-wired because of electrical currents. That'd be weird.
Yeah, and as I understand it, it was two dogs that were brought in at different times, right?
So,
I don't know how you would just dismiss that, you know?
Right.
Again, it could lead to, you know, nothing. It could lead to somebody's blood that was there. It could, you know, but at the same, it could lead to what they call them, old burial sites, I guess, that was common back in the day. Could have even something like that, but yeah, it's got to be pursued.
Yeah, I mean, we know through the police statements that they, and through communicating with law enforcement, that they have looked at that property. They have searched the property. It's sort of a gray area whether they searched inside or just outside, because we heard both.
Yeah, I think they searched outside. I think they were acting on a tip that they got early on about, well, you guys talked about it on your podcast, but about some burning that was going on out there.
Oh, yeah.
But and I had a similar situation. When I was in the area actually doing the route, doing the drive, going to UMass and all that, at that time there was a big lead at a horse cemetery. They had found some remains. And these remains were found right off of a major highway. So they were thinking this could be Mara, that, you know, somebody dumped her body and right off of the highway. So I spent a lot of time over in that area. It was in Littleton, and spent a lot of time on that. It ended up being nothing, or it ended up being it was like an old cemetery was around there or something like that. So,
yeah.
But you know, I don't regret it. I mean, I had to go and spend time around there and. you know, it just turned out to be nothing. So,
yeah, I mean, crossing things off.
But you can cross it off.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way to make progress, you know, and no one's going to be satisfied until this new lead is searched and we find out exactly what's there.
So for all we know, maybe law enforcement is looking at the property and they've gone in the past maybe 50 years or so and found that there's a burial ground, one of those small cemeteries. I mean, they have to have records of when properties were developed and homes were built, I assume.
Right. And again, we don't know what the police know and what they don't know, what they have, what they don't have. So
yeah,
all we can do is be on the sidelines and complain about the lack of job that they're doing or whatever, but ultimately we don't know what's going on behind the scenes there, and they may have a lot more information than we think, and they may be pursuing other leads that we're not thinking about. So
it's true, they could have leads that they're following up on right now, something that leads them to have strong indicators that they believe the outcome of this case is something completely different than what we're talking about right now.
And unfortunately, I don't believe this, but they could be sitting on their hands too. So I don't believe that, because that would be, you know, pretty crazy with all the amount of attention that this case has gotten, that they would just sit on stuff. I don't think that I don't think personally that that would happen.
No, I don't think so. I mean, they have a cold case unit devoted to cold cases in that state.
Right.
And I know resources are tight, but
they just hired a couple new members of the cold case unit recently in the past month. Well, Clint, you said that you took a step back from this for a little while. Is that permanent? And also, why did you take a step back from this?
You know, I'm just to the point where I don't have that much more to contribute. I've said my piece many a times. You know, whether people believe it or not, that's up for their own interpretations of my information. But I try to be as accurate and as factual as I can. And but at the same time, I'm not pursuing any new leads, because I'm pretty much at the end of my rope. I don't know what happened to her, and I don't really even know where to go at this point. And the folks that I wanted to talk to have not ever agreed to be interviewed by me. Lieutenant Scorenza, I've reached out to him 3 different times. I've never heard back from him. I would have loved to talk to him. Folks like that, that's who I want to talk to. And so really, yeah, I'm just at the point now where I'm kind of waiting and hoping something develops.
Well, I can hear you shuffling through papers over there. I'm concerned that you doing this is going to cause you to relapse into the spiral again.
I have my folder locked up. I can't even get to
it. Don't lie.
No, I have papers in front of me, but that was just to make sure I covered stuff that I didn't get off on a tangent on anything, and I stayed as focused as possible. So
I see.
Try to do that for you guys.
Is there anything in that we appreciate it? Is there anything in those papers that you want to hit on?
Well, let's see here. I want to ask you. I want to play journalist again.
Okay, yeah.
I haven't done that in a while, so I want to ask you what was your impressions of the supervisor that you had on, Mara's supervisor? I know you guys got to spend some time with her and interview her. What were your impressions on her and how she came off?
That's so weird. I had her name written down because I knew you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, she's a great lady. She came in and was really kind of, I think she had like just come from the gym, perhaps. She might have been a little amped up, but she strikes me as the kind of person who kind of has a lot of energy naturally. Certainly spoke very, with a certain speed that a lot of people on YouTube commented on.
Certain cadence in her speech pattern.
Yeah. But super genuine person and really cared about Mara and has been affected by this and her story, Mora's story, all these years.
One thing that I took from it was that she was very confident with the things that she remembered, but she also was very honest about the things that she didn't remember. So that struck me as very genuine, because she would say, I just don't remember that. And she wasn't trying to fill in the blanks and coming up with some narrative that didn't happen just so it didn't look like she had forgotten, or forcing herself to think something happened that actually didn't happen.
Right. And I never talked to her face to face. We did email, a lot of emails and that kind of thing. But I could easily tell that she was impacted by, you know, and she kind of feels guilty. I could tell that in the email. So I feel really bad about that for her.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, I don't think she has anything to do with Mara's disappearance, or and I don't think she could have done anything to stop Mara from leaving UMass at all. So.
Right, absolutely.
Totally not. Agree. Yeah, I don't know what more she could have done.
I thought she was. Yeah, I thought she was a good. You know, she offered Mara, you know, assistance. Offered to talk to her. Offered to go up to the dorm room with her. Offered to even take her to see some counseling that night that she encountered her. So yeah, I think she's her heart was definitely there. So,
I mean, you can look back at her and understand her regret and thinking that she could have done more, but. Everything, you know, hindsight's 2020, or in Tim's case, 2015. You can really second guess yourself all the time when a tragedy happens and you were connected to it 24 hours ago.
Oh, exactly.
You can always say, oh, and I could have done better.
We're talking about the time. Still confused about the time that she actually encountered Mara, but I honestly believe it was around 1 a.m. That's what she told me in our email conversations, and I know that I think she said 10:30 on your podcast there, but it's easy to get that confused because of that schedule for what Mara did, her job as a dorm monitor. That schedule is goofy. That Thursday night's shift just happened to be the day that we're talking about in question, that Thursday night shift. It's not considered a weekday shift, and it's not considered a weekend shift. It has no – if you go to the UMass police website, Thursday is almost – it's not even classified as anything because it is the one day where their hours are extended till 2 a.m. That's what they're supposed to work till. Every other weekday, it's midnight is when they finish their shifts. And every weekend, it's like 2 or 3 a.m. I don't remember off the top of my head. But Thursday is the one day, not called a weekend day, and it's not called a weekday day, but the shift ends at 2 a.m. that day. And she encountered Mara 45 minutes before Mara's shift was supposed to be over. So that tells me it's 1 a.m. and not 10:30. But neither here nor there, I guess.
Well, I think you're right. Yeah, I think based on some of the research, or her call, Mora's call with Kathleen was somewhere in the 10 o'clock hour.
It was 10:10 to 10:38 p.m.
Yeah.
So, when the supervisor encountered Mara, Mara was not on a phone at all. So she didn't encounter her at 10:30 p.m. And that's just a fact.
Right.
And where does that lead us to at this point, that it was just a wonky day of the week, and so many years later, Karen misremembered that specific time?
Yeah, because, I mean, I bet she encountered Mara. You know, she probably visited Mara every night that Mara worked, and most nights it was probably right around midnight or right, you know, within a half hour or so before midnight. So I think it'd be easy to confuse that information.
Yeah,
because that's the one night of the week where, you know, the person's working till 2 a.m., you know. Going even back to the disappeared show, when you've rarely ever heard from Mara's friends, but when they were on the show and you hear their answers and you hear answers from family over the years, I've always tried to find a word to describe it because I didn't want to sound critical necessarily, but to me, it sounds like they're saying stuff that's easier to accept, and I don't know the word for that, but easier to accept than what they even actually believe. That's my personal interpretation. I could be wrong on that, but that's something I picked up early on about this case, that I felt like I'd hear people say stuff that they didn't necessarily really believe, but it was just easier to accept, to say that, you know, Mara didn't have her dorm room packed up because she just didn't have time to unpack over winter break. And, you know, there's many examples like that. You know, she was just going away to clear her head for a couple of days. She'd gone away in high school. She had gone away for a day in Boston. So to see that proves that she was only going to be going away for, you know, and that's something that she does. You know, I don't think that's a fair comparison, by the way, because that's a whole different scenario. But so, you know, that kind of stuff is kind of, you know, what led my theory of suicide. You know, early on, I was pursuing stuff and trying to find out who's telling the truth here, who's lying, and who's, you know, is it the cops that are out there spreading all kinds of bad information, and I never were able to find, I always found them to be pretty consistent. You know, you can say they don't ever say nothing and they don't ever tell you anything good, but they, if you go and read early articles to more recent articles, the cops have pretty much stayed on point, you know, the whole time. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but you know, the consistency's always been there with the police, as far as I can see it.
Do you mean that the people who are interviewed and they give answers, they are giving sort of easy answers because they don't want to elaborate into something?
Or they're playing
specific?
A psychological trick on themselves? Is that what
or
you're
is
getting
it
at?
That? Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, you know, James Renner's another guy that I think has did that in the past when I've heard him talk about more. And, you know, he kind of has this tandem driver, had the tandem driver theory, but he always had like a positive outcome for her, that she's living it up in Canada and stuff like that. I don't think he really believes that, but I think he wants to believe that that's what happened to her. And that's the kind of thing I'm trying to say about what I hear when I hear these, when I hear people talk about the case. And I could be wrong. You know, that's just my interpretation.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine what a friend of Maura would rather believe. Like that she was suicidal, right, or that she was met with by some horrible murder.
Right. And to be clear again, Maura could have very well been depressed, went into the White Mountains and still not committed suicide. So
right.
That, you know, that's completely, there's no information that backs that up, that she actually committed suicide. So,
right.
Yeah, I have heard that she wasn't very happy. And matter of fact, I heard from a source that is a friends with Kathleen Murray, who I guess talking to Kathleen had described Maura as miserable in the time frame before she went missing. So how accurate is that? You know, again, that's like third party stuff, and I understand that, and it's, you know, but I believe it to be credible. So my source anyway.
What's your thoughts on the recent tragedy of Cecil Smith?
You know, that's very sad. I mean, anytime somebody they get to that point where that's the only option left for them, that's really sad. And unfortunately, you know, we don't know what was behind that. I don't know Cecil Smith personally. I've only heard him one time when he was on the Oxygen show, so I have no clue what was going on in his life that led him to that. You know, I hope it has nothing to do with the Maura Murray case. But honestly, have no clue what happened there. But, you know, it's just sad all around.
It certainly is sad. And on top of the tragedy itself, it's sad to see some of the reaction that's out there, where people now want their theory about why he did this to be the
right
case. And that it's to assume that he did it for this reason or that reason is irrelevant.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
And it
totally agree with that.
It shouldn't be a public forum. It should be a public forum about how to prevent stuff like this.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, as we sit here on February 25th, we've heard no official statement as to why Cecil committed that. So yeah, definitely don't want to comment on what we think might have happened. But we did hear, for whatever it's worth, we did hear that he had early onset Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and I'm sure that would weigh heavily on somebody. You know, you just, but like I said, you just hope that it has nothing to do with the Maura Murray case. But, you know, both, not just from a standpoint of, you know, him being accused or him being looked at as involved in a police conspiracy, but yeah, it's just sad all around.
You have to keep in mind that this is the man who arrested the former chief of police for driving while intoxicated, and he became chief of police. So this isn't somebody who plays fast and loose with the law, as far as I know. Everything that we've heard is that he was a by-the-book guy when it came to how he implemented the law. He just strikes me as a good cop.
Well, and that's the other sad thing about this case is he is one of the original cops that actually saw the car, actually talked to a very good witness in Atwood, and we don't have him around anymore. So that for this case, that's sad, right?
Yeah.
And then you have we have Mr. Streslin, who's out talking, who will give some statements every now and again about the case. The problem with him, though, he's a precedent guy. You know, he's going to set precedent. He's not going to, he's not really so concerned with the details of this case. He's concerned with keeping the precedent for his police and his justice system over there. The folks that we need to talk to were people like Cecil Smith, John Scorenza, Chris Thrasher, Brian Davies, actual officers that actually physically worked on this case. These are the guys that can clear up stuff for us. These are the guys that can maybe dispel some of the rumors. I don't think they'll ever get away from the police conspiracy angle. There's too many people that have a strong feeling about that. So they're not gonna, you're not gonna talk to them and get that completely resolved. But at the same time, those are the people that I'd want to hear from on this case right now. We did get to hear from Mr. Monahan, and that was good. And I found him to be pretty credible. Like to maybe hear a little bit more from him. You know, kind of want to like to learn more about his thought process that night. But, you know, other than that, you know, Scorenza is going to say what he's going to say, but he, you know, we're never going to get a whole lot out of him. I don't believe.
Yeah. I think he would have surfaced by now if he was ready to say anything. He didn't. I meant
Streslin. I mean, when we hear Streslin talk, we're never going to get a lot out of him as far as the case goes.
Right. You don't get to his position by,
right,
by you know,
giving away the farm
on every investigation because a couple podcasters and guests are like, we deserve answers. You're like, oh, yeah. Pardon me, guys.
Well, Lance, there's a huge community of people out there who are demanding answers as we speak.
They are lighting the torches and marching to Troop F right now.
I did see some people talking about writing letters or things like that, and and I think that's a good place to put your energy. But I will say that there is no one in the New Hampshire State House that hasn't heard of the Maura Murray case, and more specifically, doesn't know about the community of people that follow this case. It's incredible.
Right. So are you saying that the letters are useful, or are they... It's a good way to use your energy because it's not destructive.
Hurt. Yeah, of course. Right. They can't hurt, for sure.
But noted. Maybe they'll note it. Who knows? Write the letters.
Write the letters. I mean,
I'm going to shut up.
We'll keep the pressure on, but it's a guarantee that the powers that be in the state of New Hampshire know about the Maura Murray case and the large community that follows it.
In 8 months, I'm going to listen to this episode when we do our creator commentary tracks, and I'm going to completely self-efface and say, "What do you stop telling people what to do?" On Stitcher Premium.
One other thing I wanted to address. It was actually, I do have to give you guys an apology.
Oh. You don't
it
need
was
to.
The
you
Rick don't know Graves episode. I don't know how far back that was. It's been a while. I did make a comment on your YouTube, I believe it was, that I was very critical of that episode. And I don't take back my criticisms in the sense that I do feel like, you know, I wanted to hear from him. He's an important person to talk to. He's not just somebody like me who's just giving their opinions, and he was somebody that was actually there for the search, and I wanted to, and I just kind of felt like he went from the driver's seat to the back seat when you guys were interviewing him, and it just may be my interpretation of things, but you know, I'm somebody that's interpreting what I'm hearing from your podcast, so that means other people are interpreting as well.
Yeah.
So I apologize because the wording I used was horrible. It actually was not how I should have went about it. And I will say, since that podcast, I have not seen any of that kind of stuff. I feel like you guys, I couldn't even tell you what you guys think happened to Maura Murray right now, because you guys, I think, have done a really good job of letting your guests say what they have to say. You may not always agree with every guest that you have. You may not always, you know, but I feel like you guys have really, really come a long way. And I'm, you know, I may have been too harsh on you anyway over the Rick Graves episode, but I really like the way that you guys have the way you're handling this case now. So,
well, apology not accepted.
You guys know what you're doing now, for sure. Well, I don't have any doubts.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I think we had a pre-interview phone call, at least one with Rick Graves. So I think what you picked up on was perhaps us knowing where he was going with his outcome and us kind of asking questions that we probably asked a little bit more naturally in the pre-interview.
It made it
seem like we were leading him a little bit. But the fact is that everyone who was involved in those searches back then, especially in the days immediately after Fred and the family, they all said that, you know, they think Mora was met with foul play, and they said it back then. They thought it then. And so it wasn't really in Rick's mind when they were doing that search that there was any other outcome.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And like I said, man, you guys have had so many different kinds of guests on, and they've covered all kinds of different backgrounds. And that's a real credit to your podcast that I think you guys have, I don't know what episode number that you guys are on right now. But,
97.
But,
97.
I really feel like you guys have done a good job with this case, keeping the interest there and keeping the spotlight on the case. And you guys have gotten off. I think you're seasoned now. You guys are like seasoned journalists now. Yeah. I like that.
Seasoned amateur journalists.
And look around. Like, we now have this $10 million studio. So we are.
This is actually sound absorbing gold.
Yeah, gold.
Yeah, gold on the walls.
Black gold is what they call it. Interwoven threads.
And you guys are, you're not just doing Mara Murray. You got like a ton of stuff going on right now, right?
We do, yeah.
Yep.
Yep, Crawl Space and Empty Frames as well, yeah.
You know what? If you want to get into another strange case, you're like, no, I don't. the Louise Chaput case. So she went hiking and she was murdered on the trail and no one's found her killer yet. And that was in the White Mountains as well. And and we're also working on Suitcase Jane Doe from Pennsylvania. So if you want to, you know, look into the, because we really do appreciate the level of detail that you have when you look into these cases independently. And if you find anything that could be helpful, like, please feel free to contribute because we can use all the help we can get.
Well, I have heard that name before. I don't know any details. So yeah, I might take a peek into that, but I don't think I'll get anywhere the kind of involvement that I was with this case.
We need you obsessed again.
Get obsessed. Well, thanks, Clint. This has been a great chat, and it's been nice catching up with you, and hopefully informative for the listeners.
Hey, good. Always good talking to you guys. You guys are real easy to talk to. That's something I like about you. Keep it up. And hopefully we'll get some answers someday, you know.
Hope so.
It may not come how we want it, or may not come how we think it's going to come, but maybe we will get some resolution to this case.